You all have Genesis chapter 50, and for your literary pleasure this morning, a bit of John Donne. Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost o'erthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure. Then from thee how much more must flow, and soonest our best men with thee do go. Rest of their bones and souls' delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell. And poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, parenthetical, drug-induced sleep. And better than thy stroke, why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die. So writes John Donne in one of his holy sonnets. The poem is rather a, you know, who do you think you are to the personification of death. The patriarch of the nation of Israel, whose given name was Jacob, but who was later called Israel, knew that death does not have the final word in our lives. And so did his son Joseph. It is a confident belief in the providence of God that gives us the ability both to aspire for more and be content with less in the years of our sojourn here. We can press ahead for all God has called us to accomplish because we do so under His direction and by His power. But we can accept what He allows us to do, even if it's less than all we had hoped, because we are humbly grateful for even one day in which to serve Him. Today we'll review what it means to both live and die under the providence of God, recognizing that the issues of our lives and deaths can be entrusted to His capable hands. If you have your listening guide from the back of the bulletin or a script with you there, you can see the outline of the passage of Genesis chapter 50, but we want to read a little bit of it together right now. And if you're able to do so, why don't you stand with me as I read aloud. Genesis 50, verse 1. Joseph threw himself upon his father and wept over him and kissed him. Then Joseph directed the physicians in his service to embalm his father Israel. So the physicians embalmed him, taking a full 40 days, for that was the time required for embalming. And the Egyptians mourned for him 70 days. When the days of mourning had passed, Joseph said to Pharaoh's court, "If I found favor in your eyes, speak to Pharaoh for me. Tell him, 'My father made me swear an oath and say, I'm about to die. Bury me in the tomb I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Now let me go up and bury my father, then I will return.' Pharaoh said, 'Go up and bury your father, as he made you swear to do.' So Joseph went up to bury his father. All Pharaoh's officials accompanied him, the dignitaries of his court and all the dignitaries of Egypt, because all the members of Joseph's household and his brothers and those belonging to his father's household. Only their children and their flocks and herds were left in Goshen. Chariots and horsemen also went up with him. It was a very large company. When they reached the threshing floor of Atad near the Jordan, they lamented loudly and bitterly. And there Joseph observed a 7-day period of mourning for his father. When the Canaanites who lived there saw the mourning at the threshing floor of Atad, they said, 'The Egyptians are holding a solemn ceremony of mourning.' That is why the place near the Jordan is called Abel Mitzrayim, or, well, place of mourning, mourning of the Egyptians. So Jacob's sons did as he had commanded them. They carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave in the field of Machpelah near Mamre, which Abraham had bought as a burial place from Ephron the Hittite along with the field. After burying his father, Joseph returned to Egypt together with his brothers and all the others who had gone up with him to bury his father." Thanks. Please be seated. Our first observation in this chapter is simply that death comes, and death becomes, when it comes, the test of family promises. First of all, Joseph honored his father through the manner of Jacob's burial. He commanded that Jacob's body be prepared for burial in the complete manner of the Egyptians, showing him honor before all the people. We're told that the Egyptians themselves showed honor to him by mourning for 70 days. Presumably, that included the 40 days it took for the embalming process. This was a national event. Well, after all, Joseph had been the number two man in all of Egypt for quite some time, getting them through their famine and helping them to restore their balance as a nation. Notice also that Joseph honored his father's final wishes by burying his body in Canaan, in the family burial site. After getting the permission of the Pharaoh, Joseph went up to Canaan and fulfilled his father's wishes. The Pharaoh himself recognized the legitimacy of the father's request. Note verse 6. Pharaoh's officials, all of the dignitaries of his court and all the dignitaries of Egypt, went up with Joseph and his brothers to bury Joseph's father's body. They spent 7 days lamenting the loss of this man when they finally reached the location. Notice, these actions made an impression on both the Egyptians and on the people of Canaan. This is a big deal in that part of the world. The name of the location became Abel Mizraim, Mourning of the Egyptians. You know, I've observed something about scenes like this. And it's simply this: the character of everyone involved is put to the test in the responses that we make to those who have passed on before us and the promises that we have made to them and they to us. Sometimes character is actually forged by the keeping of such promises, recognizing not only a responsibility to the person who died, but also a responsibility before God to be faithful to His calling in our lives, as He was in theirs. Someone has written, "What is a family but a community of promises made and promises kept no matter what?" This is a book from the 90s called A Chorus of Witnesses. In the chapter entitled The Power of Promises, it continues, "A family is not just two or more people related by blood who happen to live under one roof. A family is not a management device by which two adults shuffle children around to the various experts who do the real rearing. A family is a community of people who dare to make a promise and care enough to keep it no matter what. A family is held together by promises. Where promises fail, families fail. The rebirth of the family can begin only in the rebirth of promise keeping." I watched a 70s rerun not long ago of a sitcom in that era, and they had a marriage service, and it was supposed to be really cool. And in the vows, they said to one another, "I promise you my faithfulness as long as we both shall love." And I thought, what does that mean? Well, in Christian terms, it should mean forever, because we should never stop loving in terms of self-giving love. But what I think they meant was, as long as this feeling lasts that brought us together, we'll be faithful. That is the sickest, weakest promise I've ever thought of and heard. That should have stayed in the 70s. Well, unfortunately, it was representative of a lot of bad promises, weak promises, made at that time. And we've seen the results of that in the ripple effect. Joseph really seemed to understand this promise idea. He saw faithfulness to his father's request to be a response to the providence of God, that in some sense it was a calling for him to fulfill this promise to his father. You know, sometimes keeping promises is inconvenient, just as it was in this story, and sometimes it requires us to do things that we would rather not do. Take this story from a brother named George Munzing in a message entitled Living a Life of Integrity. He says, "My friend was reminiscing about his father's death and told me of an experience from much earlier about the summer when his sister was looking for employment. She had two job possibilities, and one she wanted very much, and the other she didn't, but she would take as a second choice. As you can imagine, the second choice job came up first. She was offered that job. She wanted to hold out for the other, but she didn't know if the other was going to come. So she went ahead and accepted it for her summer employment. A few days later, as you could expect, the other job became available to her. And she wanted to quit the first one very much and go to the second. So she went to her father and she said, "Dad, I have a problem." And she portrayed it to him. He looked her straight in the eye and said, "Did you take the first job?" She said, "Yes." "Did you promise you would work there this summer?" She said, "Yes." And he said, "Why are we having this conversation?" Why indeed? What do promises mean for us? Notice that life goes on. And this becomes the test of faith in God's providence. Look at verse 15. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "What if Joseph holds a grudge against us and pays us back for all the wrongs we did to him?" So they sent word to Joseph saying, notice their angle, "Might be true, we're not told. Your father left these instructions before he died. This is what you're to say to Joseph. I asked you to forgive your brothers the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. Now please forgive the sins of the servants of the God of your father." And when their message came to him, Joseph wept. His brothers then came and threw themselves down before him. "We are your slaves," they said. But Joseph said to them, listen closely here, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. So then, don't be afraid. I will provide for you and your children." And he reassured them and spoke kindly to them. Notice, first of all, Joseph's brothers feared revenge from Joseph now that their father was dead. I mean, their immediate fear was reprisal from Joseph for selling him into slavery when he was 17 years of age. They went to him right away, they humbled themselves before him, and then they quoted their dead father. We don't really know whether what they said to Joseph was just conjured up or whether it was truly instructed by their father before he died. I have a hunch they just made it up, trying to save their skin, but don't know. Any way you look at it, it is an appeal made from humility and confession. They called their past actions the sins and the wrongs they committed in treating you so badly. And they were right. And they asked for forgiveness. And that was the right thing to do also. Then notice Joseph reassured them from his experience of and his confident faith in the providence of God. Notice Joseph's first response to the message sent to him by his brothers, he wept. Why was this? Well, we're not told. Perhaps he saw through their duplicity and he wept at the thought that his beloved and dead father was implicated in such a plan. Perhaps he relived in that request for forgiveness the pain and suffering that those early years after being sold into slavery brought to him. Perhaps he was sorry that he hadn't reassured them earlier and more forcefully of his genuine forgiveness of their wrongs toward him. In any case, he affirmed the providence of God and of his humble acceptance of that providence, even though it had meant hardship for him. This too was the right thing to do. It's always right to humble ourselves and to seek forgiveness, and it's always right to humble ourselves and offer it. There's no clearer expression of faith in the sovereign oversight of Almighty God than in Genesis 50, verses 19 and 20. Look at that again. But Joseph said to them, "Don't be afraid. Am I in the place of God? You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives." Wow. Here are a handful of questions for application. Here's the first one. In the face of death and of the unexpected turns of life, are we able to put our trust in God? Second, can we accept our own limitations and not just take matters into our own hands? Third, will we accept that the hand of God is at work, even if we don't yet see how? That was certainly true of Joseph's earlier years, right? What's going to come of this? Yet God was with him and caused him to prosper. Notice also, will we relinquish our sense of ownership and control over what God has given? Am I in the place of God? Asked Joseph. Well, the obvious answer is, well, of course not. And then finally, will we learn to rely on His power to fulfill our calling? As you certainly know, one of my personal heroes is William Wilberforce. I just finished reading the book by Eric Metaxas entitled Amazing Grace, William Wilberforce and the Historic Campaign Against Slavery. This came out about 12 years ago. I'm finally reading it, or read it. I'm reading another one by John Pollock, simply called Wilberforce, also a wonderful book. Wilberforce, along with a few close, influential Christian friends in the British Parliament and in society at large, in the late 18th and the early 19th centuries, made a powerful impact on the world. In fact, they changed the world ever since. They led a successful campaign to abolish first the slave trade, and ultimately the institution of slavery in Great Britain. It was a long and costly project. They endured ridicule and threats of violence. It took 18 years for the slave trade to be abolished. Between 1789, when the first bill was introduced in Parliament to abolish the slave trade, and 1807, when a similar bill was finally passed. And you can judge how they managed to change the attitude of Parliament and the nation by how that first bill was received and how the last one was received. In the first one, people laughed out loud in Parliament, thinking, that's the craziest thing we've ever heard in our lives. 18 years later, when the bill passed, Wilberforce sat while everyone else rose to their feet in a thundering round of applause and huzzas and Wilberforce and all the rest of that, weeping into his hands. That's a pretty short time to have changed the atmosphere of the nation and of Parliament. Well, finally then, I mean, I should mention this too, those who carried it after he was unable physically to do so, in 1833, passed a law against the practice of slavery within the nation and within the British Empire, which changed the world, essentially. Well, at a strategic moment early in the struggle, after a major setback, one of many, Wilberforce wrote to John Wesley. John Wesley at that time was he's probably 50 or so years Wilberforce's senior, and was dying. In fact, he died just a few days after he wrote a letter in response to Wilberforce's letter to him. Wesley had preached the good news of Jesus all around the nation and had been a part of what is called the Great Awakening, and his friend George Whitefield, even though sort of theologically on different sides of one of these divides that divides Christians, a good friend of his and a fellow laborer in the gospel. In fact, many believe that this letter was the last one that Wesley wrote before his passing a few days later. Wilberforce asked Wesley's advice as one who had written against slavery. Should he continue with such a cause? Is this hopeless? Should I give my life to something else? Because he had committed his life to this. And already it seemed like it was just not going to go anywhere. Here's the letter that Wesley wrote to Wilberforce, dated February the 24th of 1791. Notice this is just within a couple of 3 years of when the very first bill was read in Parliament. Balaam, February 24th, 1791. Dear Sir, unless the divine power has raised you up to be as Athanasius contra mundum, Athanasius against the world. I see not how you can go through your glorious enterprise in opposing that execrable villainy, which is the scandal of religion, of England, and of human nature. Unless God has raised you up for this very thing, you will be worn out by the opposition of men and devils. But if God be for you, who can be against you? Are all of them together stronger than God? Oh, be not weary of well-doing. Go on in the name of God and in the power of His might, till even American slavery, the vilest that ever saw the sun, shall vanish away before it. Reading this morning a tract wrote by a poor African, I was particularly struck by that circumstance that a man who has a black skin being wronged or outraged by a white man can have no redress, it being a law, which he put in quotation marks because of the illegitimacy of it, in our colonies, that the oath of a black against a white goes for nothing. What villainy is this? That he who has guided you from youth up may continue to strengthen you in this and all things is the prayer of, dear sir, your affectionate servant, John Wesley. Those words were powerful encouragement from one Christian soldier to another to continue in the fight for moral uprightness and Christian virtue, and simply the application of the gospel that calls us to the foot of the cross where the ground is level for everyone from every nation and tribe and tongue and language and color of skin, where we should be humbly seeking what only Jesus can do for any one of us and for all of us. And so hope continues. There's a test of covenant purposes from this day forward. Note verse 22. Joseph stayed in Egypt along with all his father's family. He lived 110 years and saw the third generation of Ephraim's children. And the children of Machir, son of Manasseh, were placed at birth on Joseph's knees, reminiscent of what had happened with his sons and his father. Then Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land, the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice that generational connection. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place. So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. Notice that Joseph lived to see the third generation of his son Ephraim's children, and his son Manasseh's children were placed at birth on Joseph's knees. This is almost the same, again, as when Jacob took Ephraim and Manasseh as his own children, even though by birth they were his grandchildren. Joseph lived to see the third generation of his family line. He also lived to 110 years of age, which is interesting. One Egyptian scholar writing in the New Bible Dictionary, of the third edition at least, said that ancient Egyptian records record that living to 110 years of age was exactly the number of years that was considered the ideal lifespan. Joseph died younger than his father, and yet, as sort of a witness, you might say, to the people of Egypt, Joseph lived exactly the right number of years to be a standing testimony to his blessing from God. Then notice that Joseph spoke at his own death of God's ultimate purpose to give his descendants the land of promise. The heritage of hope in the future promised land was kept alive in this generation too, as Joseph again reminded those family members, alive at the time of his death, of the ultimate promise and purpose of God. And then, in light of God's covenant purpose, Joseph made his people swear to take his bones back to Canaan with them when they returned. So, as we see in the story of the book of Exodus, this is just what they did. Moses received the heritage of this request 400 years later, and the promise made to Joseph, and he made sure that it was fulfilled. I want us to fast forward to this side of the coming of Jesus, our Savior. Our present hope contained in the gospel of Jesus Christ includes the promise of the future for those who belong to Him. It's not just that God will be with you in this present life, though that's a huge and big deal, and that He will help you to live a fulfilled life so that when you die, there will be something to show for it. That's also a big deal. But He says that this life isn't the whole story. There is so much more that lies ahead in the future. We looked at that last week, didn't we? Romans chapter 8. And I'm convinced, he says, that the sufferings of this present life are not worthy to be compared to the glory that will be revealed in us. That's something to hold on to, isn't it? But it is the privilege and the responsibility of this generation to pass on that legacy of faith and trust in God's oversight and purposes to the generations to come. I've thought about this, and I'm not planning to test it unless I really get a word from God that makes it obvious that I should. To make my kids make some kind of promise to me that they have to pass on to their kids and then to their kids and then to their kids for, well, how many generations does it take to get to 400 years? A lot. And yet that heritage of promise was significant, and that generational vision. This is what I guess the gist of the whole idea here is. If we are trusting in God and His providence, we can die with confidence just as we live with confidence, because we know that He's still God and He's still bringing about His purposes in the lives of those who follow us. That's worthy of confidence and faith and hope. We're holding the baton in the race of faith. We've received it from those who ran before us, and we're going to pass it to those who run behind us. And hopefully we'll urge them to grasp it as strongly and run as faithfully as we did, even though we have scuff marks on our knees and maybe our faces from having tripped and fallen a few times. We're going to get back up and keep running until we don't have breath to do so anymore. In his Breakpoint commentary, The Greatest Love for Memorial Day in 2006, Chuck Colson told about the supreme sacrifice that one soldier made for another. It was February of 1945, 3 months before the end of World War II in Europe. 18-year-old Sergeant Joseph George of Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, was stationed in Lorient, France. It was evening, and George was preparing to go on patrol. The Americans were hoping to locate landmines buried by the Germans. Sergeant George had been on patrol duty the night before, and as he told his friend, Private James Caudill, he was tired and scared, 18 years old. Private Caudill offered to take the patrol on his behalf. He pointed out that, you know, at age 36, he was nearly two decades older than George. He told George, who had already been blown off a torpedoed ship in the English Channel, "You're young, go home, get married, live a rich, full life." And then Private Caudill went out on patrol. And a few hours later, he was killed by a German sniper. Colson muses that such selfless acts, quote, echo the values and valor of generations of military men and women we remember every Memorial Day. He also briefly commented on the meaning and present application of the concept of just war, but that's kind of an aside. But then he goes on, quote, "So what of Sergeant Joseph George? He returned safely home. He married. He fathered 5 sons. And one of them, Princeton Professor Robert George, is a good friend of mine. He's devoted much of his life to fighting the moral evils of our time, abortion, embryo-destructive research, and efforts to redefine marriage in a way that would destroy it. In John 15:13, Jesus says, 'Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends.'" The story of Private Caudill and Sergeant George makes one realize more deeply what a tremendous gift this is. It's why the George family has remembered Private Caudill in prayers for 61 years. It's a little longer now because that was in 2006. You do the math. That's 74 years now. Now think about this for a moment. We are saved by God through the self-giving act of Jesus Christ, both to enjoy and to pass on the hope that is born of grace in our hearts through the initiative of Jesus. In God's providence, it is no accident that we're here today considering such truth and hope and being called to grasp that baton and run with perseverance the race marked out for us, looking to Jesus, you know, the one who got us into all this, and the one who will be waiting at the finish line when we cross it, where we will be faithful to pass that baton on to those who follow us, hopefully in our immediate families, but certainly in the next generation, however we can pass it to them. You know, I was going to say, and I'm going to say this to you guys, if I can actually talk, which is kind of a weird thing when a guy who talks for a living is speechless, but I have 5 of my grandchildren here today. It would be, would mean everything to your grandmother. And me. To know that you are taking up this baton of faith and are going to run with perseverance the race marked out for you as well. That you will keep looking to Jesus. That you'll trust Him. And you will pass that on to every single person you can in your influence as well. I'm going to stick around as long as I can to harangue you and harass you into doing so with Christian love, of course. But it's going to be up to you to pick it up and run with it. You got to make this personal in your own lives. That's true of all of us, isn't it? Well, there's a couple of slides of application. You know, they're questions. Let's look at them. Are we living together today under such grace, living and ultimately dying under the providence of God? And then, how do we need to get back under that sovereign hand today? Let's pray for a moment.